had developed the bonds known by all who share the trail through a beautiful and dangerous land. Saying farewell to Schindler was difficult. Natalie intended to spend a few weeks at Laguna visiting friends and working on her field notes, and she set up her tent near the old section house where she was a guest of the Mormon family. Alice, who wanted to explore the pueblo and sketch and paint the people and landscape, remained in Laguna with Natalie. Douglas had one more destination on his itinerary, and with his son and Whitaker, he left Laguna and rode 18 miles across the New Mexican desert to Acoma, the Sky City Pueblo, whose mission church was the architectural template for the New Mexico building under construction at Balboa Park. The men spent several days exploring the massive rock islands of Acoma and its neighbor, Enchanted Mesa. During this expedition, Douglas found and successfully climbed a legendary trail that led nearly straight up the side and onto the top of Enchanted Mesa. Douglas would be hailed as the first white man to locate and climb the ancient Lost Trail of the Acoma Indians. Whether the trail was actually lost, and whether Douglas was, in fact, the first white man to find and ascend that trail, remain open to discussion. However, Douglas's membership in the Elite Explorers Club was in recognition of two firsts, both of which occurred on his expedition with Natalie in 1913. His witnessing of the sacred Hopi flute ceremony and his ascension of the difficult and unmarked trail to Enchanted Mesa. From its inception in 1905 until 1981, the Explorers Club recognized the feats and adventures of men only. That Natalie and Alice may well have been the first white women invited to attend the Hopi flute ceremony, and that they witnessed the ceremony twice, on August 23rd at Third Mesa and on August 26th at Second Mesa, was never honored or officially recorded. On Thursday, September 4th, their grand desert dream came to an end. Natalie and Alice said goodbyes to Douglas, Eric, and Whitaker at the Laguna Station and watched them depart on the 4:30 train for Denver. Their farewell was blessed with a good omen from the snake gods. Thunder rumbled from clouds over the western horizon, and the promise of rain scented the wind ahead of the storm. Later that evening, Alice went by wagon with the Mormon boys through pouring rain to the depot and boarded the 11 p.m. train for Los Angeles. Natalie remained in New Mexico. Alice hated to leave her alone at Laguna, but knew Natalie wanted and needed to get a bit of real work done here when there's no interruptions. The heat that dogged Natalie, Alice, and company across the Arizona desert had been bearable because of the relief brought by the seasonal monsoon thunderstorms. Southern California was suffering the same intense heat that summer, but was not blessed with the rain that fell on the neighboring state of Arizona. Alice returned home to San Diego through a parched landscape. The country surrounding George Curtis's ranch was a tinderbox by late summer, and on September 16th, a terrific wildfire swept across the top of the valley near George's house. George fought a fierce wind and cleared dead brush from around his house and beehives, and his little ranch was spared. It was still hellishly hot and dry in late September, but a drizzle of rain finally dampened the fires, and George was able to work on his ranch without the demonic image of smoke on the horizon. On the night of the full harvest moon, October 15th, Natalie returned to California on the train. George retrieved her and brought her to the ranch. Over the next several days, they unpacked Natalie's bags, aired out her gear, and then repacked and stowed the camping equipment in his shed. Later that week, Natalie and George together read Roosevelt's article, The Hopi Snake Dance, which was published in the October 18th issue of Outlook. Roosevelt praised Natalie's work collecting Indian music and reiterated her plea to the federal government to create an educational system that would perpetuate Indian poetry and music. Roosevelt also gave American readers a detailed and colorful recounting of his experiences among the Hopis, especially about his time in the gray twilight of the Kiva of the Snake Priests, where he encountered the symbolism and dark savagery of their elder world. Perhaps because Roosevelt was still assessing his feelings about the modern art seen at the Armory Show, he commented on the importance of Nampeo's ceramics on the Native American aesthetic. "A great art must be living," he wrote, "must spring from the soul of the people. If it represents merely a copying of an imitation, and if it is confined to a small caste, it cannot be great. It must have made Natalie smile when Roosevelt suggested in his article that the federal government needed to design and construct dwellings appropriate to place and culture, and challenged the decision to force the Hopi off their mesa-top villages and into white man's style communities built precisely like some 10 million other cheap houses. Even Washington outsider Frank Meade, Natalie and George's eccentric friend, who had found an appreciative audience for his North African and indigenous American building designs, received a nod from Roosevelt. Mr. Frank Meade has done admirable work of the kind by adapting Indian architectural ideas in some of his California houses. Roosevelt's 6 weeks of submersion in Indian country, particularly his 3 days and 2 nights at Walpi, and his conversations with Natalie at the schoolhouse at the foot of First Mesa, had transformed his thinking. "Give a Hopi a chance to lead his own life as he ought to," Roosevelt wrote, "and realize that he has something to teach us as well as to learn from us." 10. A fine woman to be out with. The personality of which she was so tired seemed to let go of her. The high, sparkling air drank it up like blotting paper. It was lost in the thrilling blue of the new sky and the song of the thin wind in the pinyons. The old fretted lines which marked one off, which defined her, were all erased. Willa Cather. Elmira Choate Johnson died in her bed of heart complications in March 1914. She left her spinster granddaughter, Carol Stanley, the house built by J. Bishop Johnson across Dorothy Cove from Longfellow's former residence. Elmira also left her unmarried granddaughter a sizable bank account. With a home and money of her own, her grandmother gave Carol what she, as a Choate and as a married woman, always had, security. At 35, Carol had earned the means and the right to live out her days as a respected woman in the community on Nahant Island. But Carol was not interested in living out her days as the island's spinster music teacher. The staid life of nursemaid and helper that had defined the last 2 years had left her tired, dissatisfied, and restless. She held on to an image of life beyond the woman's sphere of home and community service, and yearned to return to the stimulation and challenge she had known in Boston and Baltimore. The house on Dorothy Cove and the security of her own bank account were gifts of incalculable value to a single woman, but Carol had experienced too much of the world beyond her family. She still wanted to do something with her music and with her life, and whatever that something was, it was not found on Nahant. The Lynn and Nahant Street Railway connected the island to the mainland trains into Boston, and Carol had continued to socialize with professional colleagues and friends during her mother's illness. She had also worked as a volunteer at 2 organizations in Boston. The South End Music School, where she interacted with Natalie and Canon Douglas, and the Boston Port and Seamen's Aid Society. As the daughter and granddaughter of fishermen, Carol understood the travails of seamen and their families, and gave piano concerts for boarders and visitors at the Seamen's Bethel in Boston's North Square. The Seamen's Bethel was a Methodist and Episcopalian charity organization founded by the sailor preacher, Father Edward Thompson Taylor, in the 1820s. Like the South End Music School, the Bethel was staffed by mostly female volunteers from Boston's wealthier families who worked to improve the moral, religious, and living conditions of Boston's working-class folks. Natalie wrote about Boston's South End Music Settlement School in The Craftsman in 1911 and may have met Carol during one of her tours of Boston settlement houses. Natalie and Carol were probably not aware that their ancestors may have known one another years before. Natalie's uncle George Curtis entertained Joseph Choate, a relative of Carol's great-grandmother, Elizabeth Choate, at his home in Ashfield, Massachusetts, decades before Natalie and Carol were born. Boston was populated with friends from Carol's school days at the New England Conservatory of Music. Carol also had Brahmin relatives and Nahant friends living on Beacon Hill. Her father's first wife's relatives, the Edward C. Johnson family, several Cabots, Lodges, and a few Lowells, whom Carol had known since childhood, when they lived or summered on Nahant. But Carol was not a Brahmin, and her social circle, although educated and worldly, was made up of musicians and intellectuals, not heiresses and business barons. Carol continued to play piano on the professional stage, although her opportunities were limited while she lived out on Nahant. Even though she was in her 30s and past the conventional age when women married, by the fall of 1914, Carol was dating a professional musician. Carol was no beauty, but she was witty and smart, and had pleasant, attractive features and a good fashion sense. She also had enough money to be considered independently wealthy. Carol's family on Nahant, specifically her mother's brother, Otis Johnson, feared the musician courting his niece had his eyes not on Carol, but on her very attractive inheritance. Details of the liaison are scant, but Carol evidently had a serious affair with a violinist with whom she shared the Boston concert stage. By Carol's own account, the affair ended scandalously. The violinist may have eloped with a wealthy society patroness. And Carol's friends, and possibly her family too, suggested she needed to leave town. Winfred Douglas may have been among those friends who urged Carol to sever ties with Boston, and he may have helped orchestrate her departure from New England by recommending that she join the staff at the Kindergarten Institute in Chicago. By late fall of 1914, Carol closed up her Nahant home on Dorothy Cove, packed up her belongings, and departed Boston for Chicago. From Douglas and Natalie, Carol had heard dozens of stories about desert expeditions and Indian ceremonies, about cultures and landscapes as foreign to Nahant Island as the civilizations found along the Nile. Carol never recorded when the suggestion was first made that she go with Douglas on a journey into Indian country. But in the spring of 1915, after a winter in the Midwest, Carol traveled to Evergreen, Colorado, where she embarked on a journey to Arizona with Douglas. She couldn't have known it at the time, but her introductory journey with Douglas into the American Southwest would change the course of her life, and in doing so, would significantly alter and influence the lives of dozens of other people, some of whom would leave bold and transformative marks on Southwest history. Sometime in late May 1915, Carol and Douglas took the train south and west from Denver to Durango and eventually Mancos, Colorado. From the narrow-gauge station in Mancos, they journeyed across the country below Mesa Verde and the cliff dwellings famously discovered by John's brother Richard Wetherill and his brother-in-law Charles Mason in the winter of 1888. From Cortez, they headed into McElmo Canyon and reached the San Juan River near Bluff. They continued downriver to the bridge at Mexican Hat and the last leg of their journey, south and west, across the Utah-Arizona desert, to Kayenta and their destination, the home of Louisa and John Wetherill. Douglas had become friends with the couple on previous expeditions in the Four Corners country. In 1915, Douglas was a defense witness for an upcoming trial in Denver, and on this trip with Carol, he had come to see Louisa Wetherill about locating other witnesses living on the Ute Reservation. Douglas stayed a few days at the Wetherills discussing the trial with Louisa. John Wetherill was not in Kayenta, but on an expedition with a group in the outback. And then he left Kayenta for Utah. Carol, a guest at the Wetherills throughout Douglas's meetings with Louisa, must have impressed Louisa because Carol did not leave with the cannon, but remained her house guest for the next few months. Living at the Wetherill's trading post home provided Carol with an extraordinary introduction to Indian country. As Roosevelt and his family had learned in the summer of 1913, Louisa's home in Kayenta was a desert palace in the heart of the most spectacular landscape in all of Indian country. Louisa, like her husband, had achieved legendary status among the Navajos and Utes who lived on this high desert and among the white people who wanted to experience one of the last great American frontiers. Louisa Wade Wetherill was known as Adstan Sosi, Slim Woman, among the Navajos. She had lived in Kayenta with her husband, a trader, backcountry guide, and internationally known amateur archaeologist since 1910. Louisa's stone house on the Red Desert, 24 miles south of Monument Valley, hosted adventurers, traders, writers, archaeologists, and former presidents. All expeditions to the Great Rainbow Bridge began and ended at the Wetherills, and nearly all of these were led by John. On August 14, 1909, John Wetherill and his companions, Dr. Byron Cummings and William B. Douglas, entered the historic record as the first white men to reach Rainbow Bridge. Outback insiders knew that it was Louisa Wetherill who enabled their discovery, since in November 1908, she had convinced the Navajo known as One-Eyed Man to guide her and John to the legendary stone rainbow the Navajo called Nonnezoshe. Louisa's securing of a Navajo guide was nothing short of extraordinary. Nonnezoshe was sacred to the Navajo, but the Diné had forgotten the appropriate prayer for the Great Bridge, and normally no Navajo would venture near it. Louisa Wetherill was a respected Bilagana among the native people of the Four Corners region. Born in 1877 in Nevada, Louisa grew up in Mancos, Colorado, near the ranch of her future husband's family. She spoke nearly fluent Navajo and was known and trusted by the Navajos, Utes, and Paiutes she had lived among since childhood. After witnessing Louisa's interactions with the Indians, who came to trade at the Wetherill's post during his stay in Kayenta, Roosevelt commented that she was not simply versed in archaeological lore concerning ruins and like, she was also versed in the yet stranger and more interesting archaeology of the Indian's own mind and soul. Louisa not only knows the Navajo's language, she knows their minds. They trust her so fully that they will speak to her without reserve about those intimate things of the soul which they will never even hint at if they suspect want of sympathy or fear ridicule. The Wetherill outpost at Kayenta was a desert oasis. Louisa diligently watered a garden that included Virginia creeper and rose bushes, shaded by a large stand of box elders on a front yard that boasted a grass lawn. For eastern dudes, who might forget they were in the middle of a very hot and dry desert that received only a few inches of rain a year, Louisa posted a keep-off-the-grass sign alongside her fragile green lawn. At Kayenta, Carol had a room in a dwelling unlike any she had seen in New England. The floors of the Wetherill home were packed dirt softened by Navajo rugs. The walls were decorated with more Navajo tapestries and replicas of Navajo sand paintings, Indian baskets and artifacts, and dozens of original paintings given to Louisa and John by the artists who had stayed with them. The roof was constructed of poles packed with earth, and to keep debris from sifting down onto food and drink, lengths of unbleached muslin was tacked to the ceiling over the dining table, which frequently accommodated 10 or more guests. Like their counterparts at the Hubbles in Ganado, the Wetherill's bookshelves were crammed with books on Southwest history and archaeology. The home of Louisa Wetherill was, in Roosevelt's words, a delight to the senses, clean, comfortable, with its bath and running water, its rugs and books, its desks, cupboards, couches and chairs, and the excellent taste of its Navajo ornamentation. Kayenta was the gateway to the most iconic landscape of the American Southwest. Monument Valley and its otherworldly landscape of sculpted red buttes, stone needles and towers, obelisks and colossal spires began a few miles to the north. Combe Ridge and El Capitan, Church Rock, carved the horizon to the northeast. And on the horizon to the south was the great limestone rampart of Black Mesa, whose rock fingers reached 50 miles across the desert to the Hopi Mesas. 15 miles to the west of Kayenta, a primitive road crossed Marsh Pass into verdant Tasaji Canyon, Navajo National Monument, where John Wetherill had stumbled upon the cliff ruins of Keet Seal in the 1890s and located the Anasazi cliff dwellings of Batatakan in 1909. The small cluster of stone and mud-chinked cedar post buildings that was the Wetherill's home was an island outpost surrounded by a wilderness of sand and rock. Perhaps this was why Carol felt at home in Kayenta. She was well accustomed to island living and to windows that framed views of infinity. Carol was living in a land of legendary places and people. Zane Grey's novel, The Rainbow Trail, was published in 1915, the same summer that Carol came with Douglas to the Southwest. Grey's story, set in Hopi and Navajo land, introduced urban readers to the rugged canyon lands of Arizona. 2 years before Carol moved in with the Wetherills, Grey had stayed in those same rooms and had gone with John Wetherill to Nonnezoshe. Grey scratched his name into a stone near the base of the bridge, and 3 months later, his signature was found by Roosevelt and his sons when they followed Wetherill to the sacred monument. Natalie's and Douglas's descriptions of Arizona's space, color, and hot light could only partially prepare Carol for her experiences at the Wetherills. Carol learned what Louisa had come to know as a young woman. From this hard country came beauty. The Witherells' home became the headquarters and supplier for the surveyors and archaeological teams studying and excavating the cliff dwellings and Anasazi sites in Tuckasegee Canyon and in the canyonlands along the San Juan River near Bluff, Utah. In 1909, before beginning work at Balboa Park, Edgar Hewitt and Jesse Nussbaum had stayed here and traveled with John Witherell into the vast unmapped country Hewitt was surveying for the Archaeological Institute of America. When Carol arrived for her several months' residency, the Witherells' outpost was the base camp for a young Harvard Ph.D., Alfred V. Ted Kidder, who with Samuel James Guernsey was completing a second season of fieldwork in the caves and ruins near Marsh Pass. Ted Kidder was an affable, good-humored, bearded fellow who had been on Hewitt's field teams in Bluff and McElmo Canyons and at Mesa Verde. Kidder had also worked at Hewitt's archaeological field school, frequently visited by Hewitt's pal, Charles Lummis, in the cliff dwellings of the Rito de los Frijoles on the Pajarito Plateau in northern New Mexico. If Carol's residency overlapped with Kidder's at the Witherells that spring, they surely talked about goings-on in and around Boston, where Kidder lived with his wife. They may have also talked about the land of enchantment, New Mexico, where Kidder had spent several summers in the canyon, mesa, and pine-forested mountain country west of Santa Fe, near a town called Española. Kidder loved all things New Mexican, and he may have sparked Carol's interest in the ancient Pueblo country of the Rio Grande Valley. Within the year, Carol would be in Santa Fe. Unlike Kidder, Lummis, Hewitt, et al., she would be smitten by the enchanting country of New Mexico. The first automobiles that used the rough wagon roads broken by John Witherell and his partner Clyde Colville reached the Witherell Trading Post and the farthest-flung post office in the United States in 1914. With the motor cars came a different type of visitor into the country of Monument Valley, auto tourists who, Louisa said, were impatient of delay, frightened of hardship, desiring the comfort of settled places. The Witherells, like the Hubbells, had been negotiating the desert in Model Ts a few years before the first tourists. But as Natalie, Alice, Douglas, and their co-travelers learned in 1913, even with the best of drivers behind the wheel, auto travel across sand dunes and rock ledges on roads that were nothing more than trails was laborious and slow-going. Most people came to Kayenta on horseback, or, as Douglas and Carol did in the spring of 1915, by horse and buggy. Douglas and Carol journeyed to Kayenta because Douglas was a subpoenaed witness in the trial of Tunnigat, also known as Everett Hatch, the young son of Chief Polk, Billy Hatch of the Utes. The year before, in March 1914, Tunnigat was charged with the robbery and murder of Juan Jacon, a Mexican shepherd, near Navajo Springs, Colorado. After a warrant was issued for his arrest, Tunnigat had gone directly to Louisa for advice. After hearing his story, Louisa was certain the young Ute had been set up by the real murderers, and she told him to go directly to the Ute Mountain Indian agent in Colorado and tell his story. While en route from Kayenta to the Ute agency, Tunnigat was told by an agency policeman that no one would believe he was innocent. Afraid that he would be jailed when he reached the Ute agency, Tunnigat went into hiding in the vast Indian territory of the Four Corners region. Through the fall and winter of 1914, a federal posse unsuccessfully searched for Tunnigat on the Ute, Paiute, and Navajo reservations. In February 1915, violence erupted between a frustrated posse composed of three Colorado sheriffs and 26 armed cowboys and Chief Polk's tribe living in teepees in Cottonwood Gulch near Bluff, Utah. The sound of gunfire brought over 50 more armed white men from Bluff and Blanding to the posse's aid, and several dozen Ute warriors, camped on the San Juan River with Chief Posey, rushed to help Chief Polk. The battle at Cottonwood Gulch lasted only 24 hours, but several members of the posse were killed, and dozens of Utes and white men were wounded. One Ute warrior and two Ute women were killed, and a young Ute child was wounded. Chiefs Polk and Posey and their warriors escaped into the desert, and the Utes and their allies, the Paiutes, declared a state of war with the U.S. government, warning that any whites who came near their camps would be shot on sight. In the winter of 1915, while Carol was planning her first trip to the American Southwest from the civilized comfort of a Chicago apartment, a posse of 50 Navajo policemen was assembling to pursue Polk and his band of Utes. but even the Navajos could not locate and apprehend the renegade Indians. Frustrated and fearful, the local BIA agents requested help from Washington. And by spring 1915, the Four Corners Indian Uprising was handed over to Brigadier General Hugh L. Scott of Virginia. Because Louisa was trusted by the Utes, Paiutes, and Navajos, the Indian agents working with General Scott suggested she travel into the now very hostile territory of the Utes, find the camp of Chief Polk and his family, and convince them to bring Tunnegat in for what the feds promised would be a fair trial. General Scott even promised to protect him from both the White Posse and the Navajo police. Louisa agreed to intervene and put out the word among her Navajo and Ute friends that Scott could be trusted. Chief Polk and his family came into Kayenta, and after consulting with Louisa, took Tunnegat to Mexican Hat, an outpost on the San Juan River, and surrendered him to General Scott. Newspaper writers across the United States recounted in colorful detail the Bluff War and the Battle of Cottonwood Gulch and the hunt for Tunnegat. To readers in Boston and New York, even in Chicago, the West was yet a wild place, and the region called the Four Corners, a frontier where untamed and hostile Indians roamed free. In June 1915, when Carroll traveled by buggy with Winfred Douglas from the train depot in Mancos, Colorado, across the mountains and canyon lands to Kayenta, Arizona, she was moving into a region whose residents, both Indian and white, were still reeling from the violence at Cottonwood Gulch. It was a nervous and even dangerous time in Indian country, and tourism was not encouraged. Exactly how it came to pass that Douglas left Carroll alone with the Wetherills, whether this was an impromptu arrangement made after Carroll met Louisa, or was the plan from the beginning of their journey, in a time of such hostility, it speaks volumes about the Wetherills' reputation in the Four Corners. It also reveals a good deal about the character of Carroll Stanley. In June 1915, in the pages of the only diary ever kept by Louisa Wetherill, Carroll emerges into the written record of the American Southwest. Louisa's diary chronicles her quest to locate the Indian witnesses and interpreters Tunnegat's attorney needed brought to Denver. The trial would begin on July 6th, and time was running out. So after Douglas left Kayenta, Louisa decided to go into Ute country herself, locate the witnesses and interpreter, and get everyone, including herself, onto the train for Denver in time for the opening arguments. Louisa departed Kayenta at supper time on Saturday, June 26th, in a buggy packed with enough supplies and provisions for a 4-day, 50-mile journey across the desert to the Ute Agency at Navajo Springs. This was no journey for a tenderfoot. Louisa would be roughing it, following leads to Ute camps where there would be no amenities like those found at trading posts. In spite of the challenges, Louisa invited Carroll to accompany her and Emma Charlie, a young English-speaking Navajo, and John Chief, a friend of the Wetherills. Like Natalie's and Roosevelt's camping expeditions, Carroll's outback adventure began in the long shadows before sunset. Louisa's buggy with Carroll and Emma Charlie, followed by John Chief and several horses, headed north past El Capitan and into the dusk. Before dark engulfed the desert, the light of the full moon illuminated the landscape. Carroll's first camp in Indian country was on a sandhill at the edge of Monument Valley. They did not pitch tents, and from her bedroll under the open sky, Carroll gazed at a dreamlike moonscape of stone spires. She was ecstatic, and even Louisa remarked in her diary about the beauty of the June moon on the landscape. The next day the weather was hot, and deep sand made for slow progress. They were following a road, faint tracks obvious to Louisa but barely perceptible to Carroll, that wound around the monolithic buttes, stone arches, and rock islands. After sundown cooled the desert floor, they continued to push on, and the moon rose and lit their way to Spencer's store in Goodridge. Louisa's son, Ben, and her husband, John, met their buggy and helped them set up camp. Since leaving Kayenta two nights before, Louisa's party had crossed more than 40 miles of desert. Louisa was surprised and delighted to find John and Ben at Spencer's, since they had been gone a month, guiding a Yale professor through the canyons of the Colorado River. Carroll likely met John Wetherill for the first time that night, although she would have known of him from reading the popular writings and stories of Zane Grey and Theodore Roosevelt. The next morning, Monday, June 28th, Ben Wetherill and John Chief rode south to Kayenta. John Wetherill joined Louisa, Carol, and Emma Charlie, bound northeast across the desert for Bluff. The heat was worse than the day before, and when they found grass and water for the horses at Lime Creek, they stopped for a long lunch break. There was no shade to be found for miles, so Carol and Louisa stretched a tarpaulin from the buggy to a sagebrush, and everyone crawled under and ate lunch under the tarp that protected them from the blistering sun. Louisa wasn't feeling well that afternoon, and when they reached Bluff at supper time, she was put to bed by their hosts, the Perkinses, friends who lived near the San Juan River. During the 20-mile journey that day, Carol had moved from the seat of the buggy onto the back of one of John Wetherill's horses. It was her first time in a western saddle, and very possibly her first time on a horse. Although Nahant had an equestrian community with stables that served the island's summer residents, Carol's family did not keep horses. With John and Louisa's calm encouragement, Carol rode cowboy style, astride, across a sand, cactus, sage, and stone plateau 6,000 feet above her sea-level home on Dorothy Cove. "Miss Stanley is a fine woman to be out with," Louisa wrote in her diary that evening in Bluff. "She has been riding horseback a good deal today, so is pretty tired, as she has never ridden before. She done fine, though." A fine woman to be out with. Although she did not know it, the sunburned, muscle-bruised, and saddle-sore Yankee music teacher had received the supreme compliment from Louisa Wetherill. Winfred Douglas was also at the Perkins' home in Bluff that night. The next morning after breakfast, Douglas left in an automobile with Frank Hyde and a Mr. Cornell of Bluff, both of whom, like Douglas, had been subpoenaed by the defense to appear as witnesses at the trial of Tunnegat. Douglas would accompany them to Durango, where they were all to catch the train for Denver. Louisa still had to locate several Ute witnesses and also an interpreter before she could follow Douglas to Denver. After a messenger told Louisa that Chief Polk was camped above McElmo Canyon and that he was very anxious to talk with her, Louisa, Carol, Emma, and John Wetherill headed out in the buggy and on horseback. The road to McElmo Canyon was terrible, and it took 4 hours for them to cross 10 miles. Exhausted, they slept that night on the open ground beside the buggy. In the morning, they were found by Polk's men, who led them to the Ute camp on a mesa high above McElmo Canyon. For the next several nights, Carol and the Wetherills stayed in the camp of Chief Polk and his family and went with them to Navajo Springs, below Ute Mountain, where the Sundance ceremony was to be held. Hundreds of Utes and Paiutes came to see this dance, and at sunset on the last day of June, Carol stood with Louisa and gazed out at the teepees of the Indian village where dancers in beaded costumes were gathered for the ceremonies. "It was a beautiful picture to see them riding here and there," Louisa wrote, "and the beautiful red and gold clouds over the Blue Mountain, and to hear the drum beating and the whistles blowing and the Indians singing the Sundance song." Carol woke before dawn and walked with Louisa and John into the Ute village to watch the rising sun ceremony. The dancers had been dancing for 2 days and a night without water or food, and one by one they went mad and fainted to the ground. Louisa's search for witnesses led them from camp to camp across the Ute reservation. Carol was a natural horsewoman, and by July she preferred the saddle to the buggy seat. Louisa asked Carol several times to witness her conversations with agency personnel and telegraph operators, and to listen in on and witness telephone calls to officials. After several more days of riding and camping, Louisa located the witnesses she needed, including Chief Polk's wife, who was subpoenaed to appear in Denver, and also secured a trustworthy interpreter for those witnesses. On the 4th of July, Carol was in the tiny frontier town of Mancos, Colorado, where Louisa and John had grown up and met. The community of ranchers and traders celebrated Independence Day with contests and games, pistols and firecrackers. Businesses and adobe houses were decorated with American flags and red, white, and blue bunting, but the 4th of July in this small Colorado town bore no resemblance to the annual Yankee extravaganza Carol had known back in Boston and out on Nahant Island. Carol said goodbye to Louisa at Mancos and, with John Wetherill and Emmy Charlie, headed back across the desert to Kayenta. Louisa and Tunnegat's mother took a Pullman car from Durango to Denver. Louisa was bored and lonely in the city, although Winfred Douglas, his wife, Dr. Joe, and other friends of the Wetherills came to visit her at the Kaiserhof Hotel. The trial commenced on July 6th, and after 3 days of testimony and 7 hours of deliberation by the jury, Everett Hatch, also known as Tunnegat, was found innocent of murder. The verdict cited a lack of evidence against the young Ute, and later accounts by those in the courtroom said the jury was particularly swayed by the strength of the testimonies given by the defense witnesses, specifically the statements given by a pair of Mormons from Bluff, who insisted the boy was innocent. These two Mormons may well have been Frank Hyde and Mr. Cornell, the subpoenaed witnesses who traveled with Winfred Douglas from Bluff to Denver. Carol left Kayenta by midsummer. She eventually went back to Chicago and worked at least temporarily at the Chicago Kindergarten Institute. For Christmas that year, she may have visited Nahant. She may have seen Natalie in New York and told her of her life-changing experiences with the Wetherills in Indian Country. Carol left no diary, so we can only speculate about the details of her life in the months after she left Kayenta. However, from the moment she left the Southwest, Carol was planning her return. And when she does return 9 months later with Natalie, Carol, like Natalie, is determined to make the Southwest her home country. 11. The City, Different. With a burrow to ride and a burrow to drive, there is hardly a man so rich alive. Alice Corbin. In 1916, Santa Fe, although now the capital of the brand new state of New Mexico, was still situated in a region of the United States that most Americans deemed exotic at best and primitive and downright dangerous at worst. In March of that year, civilized Americans in Boston and New York were reading about the jaw-dropping exploits of the Mexican bandito, Francisco Pancho Villa, and the raid by his guerrilla band of armed revolutionaries on the town of Columbus in southern New Mexico. 17 Americans were killed by the Villistas, and a small army under General John J. Pershing went into Mexico in pursuit of the guerrillas. New Mexico's National Guard was serving as border patrol, but Americans were discouraged from traveling in southern New Mexico. New Mexicans themselves were appalled by the exaggerated news accounts and blatant misinformation making headlines back east. Supposedly intelligent persons mistakenly reported that Villa's guerrillas were encamped in canyons near Santa Fe and that his Zapata bandits were terrorizing Albuquerque's streets. Although hundreds of miles of mountains and desert lay between the Mexican border and Santa Fe, to a New Yorker or Bostonian reading about Pancho Villa in the newspapers, all of New Mexico was under siege. H.H. Brooke and C.B. Ruggles, the owners of Cliff-Dwelling Pack Outfitters, which guided archaeologists and tourists across the mountains and into the canyons of the Pajarito Plateau west of Santa Fe, worried that their fledgling business would be ruined by inflammatory headlines in eastern newspapers, rubber-stamped their outgoing mail with their own headline. This region, Frijoles Canyon, Los Alamos Ranch, and the Ramon Vigil Ranch, is 400 miles from the Mexican border, and the war cloud causes less interest here than in New York City. Not the least uneasiness need be felt in visiting this wonderful country. Regardless of the headlines and the belief among the gentry back east that New Mexico was the home of desperados and banditos, on April 10, 1916, Miss Natalie Curtis of New York City and Miss Caroline B. Stanley of Boston arrived in Santa Fe for what they planned to be an extended stay. The ladies' appearance in the capital city and their registration at the Hotel de Vargas was noted in the personals column of the Santa Fe New Mexican. Throughout the spring and summer, as news of the Villistas' guerrilla raids, arrests, and hangings dominated the front pages of the New Mexican, the comings and goings of Carol and Natalie, numerous camping excursions in Indian country, day visits to the pueblos along the Rio Grande, were documented in the newspaper's gossip and social columns. Natalie and Carol visited the popular tourist sites in the old capital city and explored the quaint streets and small shops near the historic plaza. But they were not in Santa Fe for a vacation. They had come to New Mexico to make permanent homes and to begin new lives in this country. After Carol departed Kayenta in the summer of 1915, she returned to Chicago and worked on the teaching staff at the Chicago Kindergarten Institute, where Winfred Douglas lectured and also was a member of the board of directors. In partnership with Northwestern University, the Institute had begun a postgraduate program in music education, and Carol may have been considering a long-term teaching position there. In the fall of 1915, she went to the meetings of the Musical Education League of Chicago and became an active member of Chicago's suffragettes. In Chicago, Carol had opportunities for permanent employment in a welcoming community of like-minded professional women. But she could not forget what she had seen and felt in Kayenta and in Indian country, and with Natalie, made a plan to return. In 1914, Natalie heeded the call of duty and left George's Ranch in California and returned to New York City to continue her work on Negro folk songs. The project, underwritten by George Foster Peabody and the Hampton Institute, pleased many of her friends and colleagues, including Charlotte Mason. Everyone hoped Natalie would do for American Negro music what she had done for American Indian music with the publication of the Indians' book. Throughout 1914 and 1915, and until her departure for Santa Fe in April 1916, Natalie traveled throughout the American South, collecting folk songs, spirituals, and poems. This collection would eventually fill the four volumes titled Negro Folk Songs, published by G. Shermer in 1918 and 1919. Natalie's brother Brigham and her mother Mimsy still lived in New York, and Natalie had a comfortable apartment on West 76th Street in the same neighborhood as Winfred Douglas. New York City was a stimulating environment in 1915 and the epicenter of American cultural change. Natalie had many friends living in the city, including her outback expedition pals, Douglas and Schindler. Schindler's compositions and choral arrangements were now laced with the peculiar rhythms and atonal chants and songs heard during his 1913 journey through Indian country, and the concert programs of his Schola Cantorum juxtaposed variations of Hopi and Navajo music with Bach, Mozart, and Schubert. Years before, while working on the Indians book, Natalie had shared several Indian melodies with her former teacher, Ferruccio Busoni. In February 1915, Natalie traveled to the Academy of Music in Philadelphia to hear Busoni's use of those melodies in his composition, Indian Fantasy. With her friend Percy Granger, the Australian composer and folklorist, she listened to the Philadelphia Orchestra rehearse Indian Fantasy under the direction of Leopold Stokowski. Busoni himself played the piano for what was an emotionally charged performance for Natalie. With the first bars of the orchestral introduction, the walls melted away, and I was in the West, filled once again with that awing sense of vastness, of solitude, of immensity. 1 year later, she made her return to the immense vastness with her friend Carol Stanley, who, like Natalie, was determined to create a home in the Southwest, specifically in Santa Fe. The capital of New Mexico was on the cusp of historic change. Statehood in 1912 had prompted the Anglo-driven Chamber of Commerce and Women's Board of Trade to launch formal campaigns to attract new residents and more tourists to Santa Fe. Natalie likely suggested to Carol that they go to Santa Fe because she had many colleagues and friends here, with Hewitt, the energetic hub of Anglo society. Hewitt's establishment of the School of American Archaeology and the Museum of New Mexico in Santa Fe in 1909 had turned the ancient city into home base for legions of anthropologists, ethnologists, geologists, and linguists migrating into the state. And Hewitt's promotion of New Mexico artists, architecture, and cultural riches at the San Diego Exposition in 1915 had prompted cross-country train travelers to add stopovers in Albuquerque and Santa Fe. By 1916, Santa Fe was touting itself as the Granada of America, and in league with the Santa Fe Railway and the Fred Harvey Company, was aggressively promoting New Mexico as a destination with natural and cultural sites that rivaled those found in Europe and the Mediterranean. The exhibitions at Balboa Park had developed an appreciation and understanding of Southwestern arts and crafts among the American public, and the Harvey Company's Indian buildings along the Santa Fe Railway offered collectors and tourists easy access to Native American wares. Instead of a primitive, dangerous backwater, New Mexico was now hailed as America's pristine backyard, with stunning and spectacular scenery, charming villages and pueblos, and indigenous cultures still connected to the land, a retreat in the American West that offered peace and renewal to those weary of modern, industrial, urban life. Charles Lummis and Edgar Hewitt went so far as to predict that Santa Fe, the headquarters for the Archaeological Institute of America's School of American Archaeology, would soon take its rightful place alongside the world's great cultural centers of Athens, Rome, and Jerusalem. While working on the Balboa Park exhibits, Hewitt had also managed to supervise the renovation of the old Palace of the Governors on the Santa Fe Plaza, which had commenced in 1909. In his absence, Hewitt left the renovation in the able hands of Jesse Nussbaum, Sylvanus Morley, and Carl Lutheve. And by 1913, the renovated Palace of the Governors gave the Santa Fe Plaza a historic landmark worthy of national attention. At the Hotel de Vargas, Carol and Natalie had rooms just a block from the heart of Old Santa Fe, the Palace of the Governors, on the plaza that dated to the arrival of the Spanish in 1610. Narrow dirt roads and foot trails led from the plaza into neighborhoods of adobe dwellings with flat roofs of packed dirt. Seen from a distance, the buildings of Santa Fe seemed carved from the earth. The village was watered by the Acequia Madre, the Mother Ditch, and there were lush vegetable and flower gardens, orchards of mature fruit trees, and graceful cottonwood and elm trees shading the neighborhoods and caminos nestled in the foothills and canyons of Old Santa Fe. The Sangre de Cristo, Blood of Christ, mountains rose 12,000 feet into the sky above Santa Fe. The town itself sat at nearly 7,000 feet above sea level and was blessed with a clear, clean, dry, high-altitude climate. Never too hot, never too cold, the salubrious air of Old Santa Fe was scented with mountain pine and aspen, and canyon sage and cedar. Even at midsummer, the nights were cool, and in winter the noon sun was bright and warm, and lunch could be taken out of doors. It was the climate that attracted Santa Fe's first colony of expats. Tuberculars and others with chronic respiratory complaints left the East Coast and Midwest and checked into Santa Fe's Sunmount or St. Vincent's sanatoriums. Patients often arrived on stretchers, gasping for a last breath. In New Mexico, lungers found their breath and recovered their health. And in Santa Fe's thin, dry air and pristine atmosphere, most didn't just survive, they thrived. St. Vincent's Sanatorium was built in 1911 near St. Vincent's Hospital, located alongside St. Francis Cathedral, a few blocks from the plaza. Sunmount was under the tutelage of Dr. Frank E. Mira, who with his brother, Dr. Harry P. Mira, Jr., bought the Tent City Sanatorium in 1902. Perched on a hill just north of the old plaza, by 1916, Sunmount was more health resort than hospital. Patients could be housed in spacious cottages with their families for months at a time. The main house had modern medical facilities, but also had ample and comfortable space for the frequent and numerous social events sponsored by Sunmount's residents. These included poetry readings, evening lecture programs with local archaeologists and artists, many of whom were former patients, and performances by the Sunmount Thespian Group. Sunmount's patient population included numerous artists and writers who, after experiencing the light and life of the Indian-Spanish community nestled up against the foothills of the Sangre de Cristos, remained in Santa Fe and became permanent residents. When Natalie and Carol arrived in the spring of 1916, the Sunmount's roster of convalescing residents included the nationally known poet Alice Corbin. On April 1st, the New Mexican noted the recent arrival in Santa Fe of Mr. and Mrs. William Penhallow Henderson of Chicago. William Henderson was a painter of considerable success and national renown. Alice Corbin, his wife, was a respected poet and a founder and associate editor of Poetry Magazine, one of the most influential and important literary magazines of the time. Corbin was 35 when she was diagnosed with advanced TB. With her family, she left Chicago, the warm center of her world, for New Mexico, the ragged edge of the universe. "I had been thrown out into the desert to die," she wrote of her March 1916 exile to Santa Fe, "like a piece of old scrap iron or a rusty Ford." With her 9-year-old daughter, little Alice, Alice and Will Henderson moved into a cottage at Sunmount where it was believed Big Alice might die. But with the care of the staff and the healing attributes of the clear air of Santa Fe, Alice Corbin recovered from tuberculosis. Instead of ending her life in desolate exile, Corbin found a new world of beauty. Like a dozen other creative artists and writers who convalesced at Sunmount, Alice and Will Henderson were enamored of the people and lifestyle of the quaint town of Santa Fe, and invigorated by the variety and the vitality of the indigenous cultures thriving in New Mexico. The Hendersons moved out of Sunmount and into a primitive adobe dwelling on the mostly uninhabited Telephone Road, so named for the telephone line that used its right-of-way, and in the next few years built a comfortable home where they raised their daughter, pursued their art and craft, and became the nucleus of Santa Fe's art colony. Natalie had suffered respiratory ailments since she was a child, and at 41 her health continued to concern her family and friends. She spent the winter of 1916 in California and was in good health when she arrived in Santa Fe in April. However, in the months that followed, Natalie and Carol embarked on several strenuous expeditions, and by midsummer, Natalie would take a room at St. Vincent's Sanatorium for a few days of rest and recuperation. Natalie and Carol were introduced to the Hendersons that summer, perhaps by their common friend, Edgar Hewitt. At the Hendersons' adobe home on the renamed Camino del Monte Sol, Road to the Sun Mountain, the name used by the locals, there could always be found a friendly and energetic group of artists and archaeologists sharing coffee, conversation, or cocktails. As Alice Corbin regained her health, she promoted Santa Fe as a writer's colony and, imagining a dynamic new literary arts center in the West, encouraged her many literary friends to come out to New Mexico and visit her splendid home. The American writer Willa Cather and her companion Edith Lewis came to Santa Fe in the summer of 1916. Cather and Lewis had visited Mancos and Mesa Verde the summer before, and had traveled on the same Denver and Rio Grande narrow-gauge railroad from Denver, up and over La Veta Pass, and across the valley to Durango, which had brought Carol and Douglas to Mancos a few months ahead of them. In Mancos, Cather heard the story of John Wetherill's brother's discovery of Mesa Verde while looking for lost cattle in the canyons below the cliff dwellings. With Lewis, Cather spent a week climbing about the unexcavated cliff dwellings in the rough country of Mesa Verde's cliff and soda canyons. During her stopover in Santa Fe, Cather visited the villages and pueblos of the Española Valley and explored Taos and the small villages found in the mountains north along the Rio Grande. Cather was working on the first draft of My Antonia, but the landscape and people of the Southwest had cast their spell on her, and she had begun to gather the material that would become the professor's house. Santa Fe's population and infrastructure were undergoing a historic transformation the spring that Carol and Natalie unpacked their bags in the Hotel de Vargas. The new Museum of Art, designed by the same Rapp brothers who had designed the Cathedral in the Desert, the New Mexico building at Balboa Park, was under construction on the northeast corner of the plaza. The new art museum, as it was colloquially called by the locals, was under the direction of Edgar Hewitt, who was also the director of the School of American Archaeology, which in 1917 changed its name to the School of American Research. In Santa Fe, artists and archaeologists shared the same professional and social circles. Hewitt and the Chamber of Commerce were energetically promoting Santa Fe as the city different. Hewitt's New Mexico exhibits at Balboa Park had aroused national attention in the art and culture of New Mexico, and capitalizing on the popularity of all things New Mexican, he invited nationally known artists to spend a summer in Santa Fe. The Chamber of Commerce helped visiting painters find inexpensive housing, of which there was a plethora, and Hewitt offered artists work and exhibit space free of charge at the Palace of the Governors. Artists and writers began to arrive in droves. Santa Fe, like Paris, promised artists and intellectuals an inexpensive bohemian life, unrestrained by traditional social rules and mores. No paved streets, no automobiles, one sewer line. A passenger could ride all over town in a horse-drawn taxi for a quarter. The word was getting out. In New Mexico, a new society based on art and creativity was flourishing within and alongside some of the oldest and most picturesque indigenous communities found in North America. Although the new art museum would give the community its first real exhibition space, The residential artists valued Santa Fe's primitive qualities as much as its exquisite sunsets and sparkling vistas. In 1916 New Mexico, there were few automobiles and only a handful of roads that could accommodate them. Transportation of people and goods was by horseback, in buggies and wagons, and on the backs of burros. Electricity, indoor plumbing, telephones, and central heating were rare in private homes and most businesses. Spanish was spoken more than English, and although the tourists' hotels, restaurants, and upscale shops and businesses located around the plaza had the amenities and services found in modern America, the persona of Santa Fe and environs was still that of the frontier outpost at the end of the Santa Fe Trail. Hewitt's tactics to attract a colony of artists to Santa Fe were very successful. Several years before the new museum opened in November 1917, the studios in the Palace of the Governors were home to Balboa Park artists Gerald Cassidy, Donald Beauregard, who was with Wetherill, Cummings, and Douglas when they reached Rainbow Bridge, and Carlos Vieira, who with his wife remained in Santa Fe after recovering his health at Sunmount, and to Santa Fe part-time and full-time residents William Penhallow Henderson, Paul Berlin, and George Bellows, among others. And in the summer of 1916, after much effort, Hewitt brought American art headliner Robert Henri to Santa Fe. Hewitt initially wanted Henri's advice about the contemporary art exhibit that would open the Art Museum in 1917. But by the fall of 1915, Hewitt wanted to convince Henri to come to Santa Fe and set up his painting studio in one of the spaces at the renovated Palace of the Governors. Having Henri in residence would bring the Santa Fe art colony and the formation of the new art museum national attention. After months of correspondence, the Henris accepted Hewitt's invitation and made plans to arrive in New Mexico by midsummer of 1916 for a several-month stay in Old Santa Fe. After all of 3 days in the comfortable and civilized accommodations of the Hotel de Vargas, Carol and Natalie packed up their gear and struck out for the Pajarito Plateau west of Santa Fe. Their destination was the Pajarito Club at the Ramon Vigil Ranch, a few miles and several canyons from Edgar Hewitt's cliff-hugging field school in El Rito de los Frijoles. The Pajarito Club, a small rustic guest ranch tucked into Pajarito Canyon, had been owned since 1913 by four Michigan-based partners, Roy D. Chapin and Henry Joy, executives of the Hudson Motor Company and the Packard Motor Company, respectively, and the brothers Paul and David Gray, Detroit bankers. The Pajarito Club was built primarily as a vacation retreat for its wealthy owners, their families, and friends. The Ramon Vigil Ranch and the Pajarito Club were managed by a fifth partner, Ashley Pond, who lived with his wife and three children at the club. Pond was a former member of Roosevelt's Rough Riders, who, after coming to New Mexico to recover his health, had become an avid outdoorsman. Pond's dream was to start a boys' school in New Mexico, where young men from back east would be educated in the great outdoors. In April 1916, when Natalie and Carol made their first visit to the Ramon Vigil Ranch, Pond and his Detroit partners were very much at odds, financially and otherwise, about the purpose and future of the Pajarito Club. Was it to remain a rustic outpost for private expeditions, or ought the club become a luxurious dude ranch that catered to paying guests? This country was the same plateau that Charles Loomis had hiked and explored with Adolf Bandelier before 1900, and within the 32,000 acres of the Ramon Vigil Ranch were dozens of unexcavated archaeological sites, including prehistoric cliff houses. Pond wanted the partners to invest in improvements in the existing lodge and cabins so the club could accommodate more guests. But the Detroit partners wanted the ranch they rarely used. The Gray brothers had yet to lay eyes on the place, to cost them no money until they figured out what they wanted to do with the remote property. At the very least, Pond thought the owners ought to visit the ranch and appreciate the truly spectacular piece of New Mexico real estate they owned. Exactly what Natalie and Carol knew about the Pajarito Club's status during their first stay at the ranch is unknown. They likely chose to stay at the guest lodge because of its proximity to Hewitt's Field School in nearby Frijoles Canyon. Although archaeological teams rented the rustic cabins of the Pajarito Club during their fieldwork at sites on the Pajarito Plateau, ranch guests were more often wealthy visitors from back east, looking to explore the New Mexican wilderness for a week or two. The canyon of El Rito de los Frijoles, in which Hewitt and his students and colleagues had spent years excavating cliff ruins and ancient Pueblo villages, was a 600-foot-deep cut in the massive Pajarito Plateau on the southeastern flank of the